You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Cole Donovan of the U.S. Department of State, and it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to today's discussion on bringing driverless cars from research to international markets, and introduce you to Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Science, Space, and Health, Dr. Jonathan Margolis. As a member of the Senior Executive Service, Dr. Margolis oversees policies and programs in the areas of international science and technology cooperation, international health and biodefense, and space and advanced technologies. He has also conducted courses at the University of Maryland, American University, and at the Foreign Service Institute on these areas. Dr. Margolis began his career at the Department of State as an American Association for the Advancement of Science Policy Fellow and has worked in numerous bureaus and divisions at the intersections of science and diplomacy. With that, I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Margolis.
Morning, everyone. Morning. My name is Jonathan Margolis, and I do work at the Department of State as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Science, Space, and Health. It's my pleasure to be here today with the Brookings Institution, and I really would like to thank Brookings and Ben Wittes especially for pulling together this distinguished panel to talk to us today about autonomous vehicles. Let me also thank my colleagues from the Embassy of Germany here in Washington for their work in bringing together some of the panelists today. The topic for today is one that's near and dear to the Obama administration. I think most of you in the audience know that the Obama administration has placed a huge emphasis on the critical role of science, technology, and innovation. S&T underpins many societal goals, whether they're security goals, economic goals, environmental goals, health goals. S&T is at the center of them. And today, science is global. Many countries around the world are increasing their investments in R&D, and that's true of both OECD countries and especially non-OECD countries who have aspirations to develop further and build their economies. And in the United States, we're facing a situation where we have to start thinking about how our scientists can engage not only domestically but much more internationally, globally, so that they can get access to the best minds that may be out there, some of which are here, some of which are maybe outside our borders, and the best institutions, some of which are here, some of which may be outside of our borders. In the State Department, we have a concept that we call science diplomacy. Through it, we think about using science to advance our diplomatic goals and using diplomacy to advance our scientific goals. This is very much the goal here is to use science to address some of the global challenges that may exist out there, and the answers to those challenges may come through international collaborations on science. This is part of what Secretary Kerry has referred to as the shared prosperity agenda, a way of raising economic growth in other countries around the world. In my part of the State Department where I work now, in the Bureau of Oceans, International, Environmental, and Scientific Affairs, we maintain over 50 bilateral science and technology cooperation relationships with other countries, the goal of which is to advance our science and technology cooperation as part of the broader agenda that the State Department might have for building its relationships overseas. One of those countries is Germany. And we're here today in large part because 2 days ago, experts from the United States and Germany met to discuss bilateral science and technology cooperation as part of what we call the U.S.-Germany Joint Committee on Science and Technology Cooperation. That's one of the ways that the State Department advances science diplomacy. And in this meeting that I described that we had 2 days ago, we identified areas of joint cooperation. One of those areas was e-mobility. And so the topic specifically that we'll be talking today is very much on the minds of those of us who are engaged in the bilateral cooperation between the United States and Germany. E-mobility is a piece, a central piece of the Obama administration's national innovation strategy. And the discussions that took place earlier in the week, formally between the two governments, discussions that will take place here today, fit squarely with President Obama's prioritization of advanced vehicle technology as part of what will be the soon-to-be-released National Strategy for American Innovation. This technology, I think you all know, judging by the interest here today, could be a transformative technology. Experts talk about this in terms of not only the technology spin-offs that you might have, but also reducing traffic fatalities potentially It says so here. I'm not sure it's true, but to zero. The panel will discuss that, I'm sure, by 2050. Doing so, however, will require a major, major investment, not only in R&D, but a whole range of other issues. In the Obama administration's budget for 2016, it doubles the request for investment in autonomous vehicles and proposes a number of pilot programs to prepare the roadways for safe introduction of these vehicles. Clearly, that's a U.S. priority. But if you think about this in the international context, the technologies that are going to be involved, the applications will go far beyond our borders. And so we need to cooperate with other countries at every stage of the development process, particularly those countries that have major automobile exporting capabilities and manufacturing capabilities. The major manufacturing companies in countries such as Germany, Japan, United States, others as well, where the largest auto manufacturers are in the world, will need to cooperate on the development of the technologies, but also on the diffusion of those technologies and the environmental and health and safety regulations that are going to be part of making this technology as transformative as it can be. And that brings me to this next point, which I'm sure the panels will discuss, and that's the enabling environment that will be necessary to create to make the technology work. We need to work together internationally to make sure that the new market can take advantage of the best approaches towards innovation and technology diffusion, safety issues, intellectual property rights protection, market conditions, a whole range of things to make this possible. The individuals that we have on this panel today, I think we're in very good hands. I was privileged to be with the group at the beginning about what topics they might cover, and I think you're in for a real treat today in the sense that the folks that we have here cover a wide range of capabilities, not only from the development of the technologies, the vision for where we're trying to get to using those technologies, the implications for society as those technologies get applied outside of a government context, and then ultimately the international implications and how those international cooperation mechanisms might be necessary. So with that as kind of the preview of what we're going to do and why we're here today, let me say again how delighted I am to be here to express the State Department's joy at co-sponsoring this event, and I'll turn the floor over to Ben now to moderate the session. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming out on a beautiful morning when we would all normally be outside to talk about driverless vehicles. I want to do this in as discussion-oriented a way as possible. So the panelists have all agreed to sort of dispense with opening presentation statements, and we're just going to go right into a conversation. I'm going to introduce the individual panelists as I direct initial questions to them, and so as to not gum up your time with repeating information that is lovely point up, all available in the handouts that you were given as to their full bios. A couple of things, we will take audience questions, and so, you know, as you have a question, please do wait for a microphone to come find you because we are being recorded and broadcast. And please, when you speak, introduce yourself and say who you are, and frame things in form that would be recognizably a question. So I want to start with Jessica Altschul, who is a manager of outreach and innovation policy at Daimler North America. And I want to start by defining terms a little bit. We all say the words driverless cars as though we are all talking about the same thing when we say that, and B, as though there's some generally recognized definition of a driverless car. This morning I was driving in a non-driverless car, my son, to where he needed to be this morning, and I had to explain to him what a driverless car was, and actually it's hard because certain levels of driverlessness have been with us for a long time, anti-lock brakes, cruise control, various autonomy features, and yet the phrase driverless car connotes a certain, you know, total autonomy. And so my question is, what the heck is a driverless car, and what is it in practical terms today, and what are we aspiring for it to be in the future?
That's a heavy first question, but before I answer it, I really want to thank Brookings for tackling this issue and the other panelists for being here, because I think this is definitely an issue that is going to only grow over the next several years and a couple of decades, and I think it's much bigger than a lot of people recognize, and I hope that some of the remarks today will get that point across a little bit, also in the international context. But to answer the question, or attempt to, a driverless car, I think, may be a little bit of a misnomer. Really what we're talking about is an automated vehicle, and there are different levels of automation, some of which, as you said, are here in cars today, especially in some new cars. You know, we're looking at currently in some of our Mercedes-Benz vehicles, technologies that are far beyond just cruise control, but adaptive cruise control and lane assist, active brake assist, these kinds of things that can really take over if you're having an emergency as the driver in the car, to brake for you to avoid an accident, things like that. So looking forward, taking that as the current situation, looking forward to say 2025, 2030, we're looking at a level of automation on the SAE scale that could be a fully automated vehicle by that time frame, which would mean that there still would be a driver, but the definition of driver would also change, just as the definition of a car has changed in the past 50 years and 100 years, and will continue to change as we move forward. So really what we're looking at is a driver who is more of a manager, a vehicle manager. In the heavy duty side, we're looking at a logistics manager sitting behind the wheel rather than a truck driver. And that role would really be for monitoring and being able to step in if there is some sort of glitch or problem with the system. But the way that Daimler sees this issue moving forward and our vision for autonomous vehicles in the future is really kind of, on the passenger car side, a mobile lounge, which will allow passengers and drivers to have a more relaxed environment as they are getting from home to work or home to daycare or wherever you need to be, but still be able to take over on a Saturday morning when you really want to drive on a nice country road, something like that. On the heavy duty side, also, we, as many of you know, produce Freightliner trucks and school buses, et cetera. And just this week, we released our Freightliner Inspiration, which is a fully autonomous 18-wheeler heavy-duty truck, which has a license now to drive in Nevada on its own with a logistics manager behind the wheel for testing purposes. And there are two of those on the road now in Nevada. So I think that this has implications for most of us on the passenger car side, but looking at freight management and logistics, it can have huge implications as well. So I hope that starts to answer the question of this progression of autonomy as the years go by, starting with where we are today.
So it does beautifully, but I want to follow up on the fully autonomous truck, because I suspect that a lot of people in the audience walk in here without the sense that there are fully autonomous 18-wheel vehicles driving around Nevada. And I mean, did you know that? Because I didn't when I walked into Brookings this morning. And just to tell us about the truck, what does it do? What does a fully autonomous 18-wheel vehicle mean? And how autonomous is fully autonomous? And what happens if it, you know, what does it do?
I don't want to get too into the details, but I will say that for those of you who study logistics management, freight, these kinds of issues, this has such the implications of something like this for the trucking industry and for freight management in the United States and in other areas is huge. This car, the truck, will have a driver, not called a driver, who will be more attuned to where other trucks are, where they need to go, what the fuel economy is looking like. Certainly in the future, the powertrains for these vehicles, we're looking at fully electric or hydrogen. So this has implications in the environmental sphere as well. So the future of trucking we see is certainly a large part due to platooning, and this kind of automation will definitely help with that. The fuel economy, as I said, is going to be greatly impacted by platooning and by these kinds of technologies such as the adaptive cruise control. When trucks can stay a certain distance ahead of another and travel at exactly the same speed, regulated not by a person's foot on the pedal, but rather by the computer within the truck, that has enormous implications. So that kind of a system, I think, moving forward is going to change the trucking industry. It's going to change the jobs, what it means to be a truck driver, what it means to be a logistics manager, and how we get goods in this country from place to place, especially because trucking accounts for a very large percentage of the gas use in this country. The MPG is obviously much lower on a truck than on a passenger car, and it also is contributing to the wear on the roads, et cetera. All of these issues can be impacted by a level of autonomy that we're moving forward in the trucking sphere.
Thanks. So Carl Joseph Kuhn is head of reliable automation and control at Siemens Corporate Technology for new technology fields. I'm interested in your sense of the research and development necessary to actually accomplish the vision that we just heard. What are the missing pieces? What do we need to develop that we haven't developed? And in the spirit of the sort of international side of this conversation, how much of that is U.S. technology? How much of it is non-U.S. technology going to be? And what's the interaction between the two?
First of all, thank you for the invitation to this interesting panel discussion. And the road to automation or autonomous cars is not just the road with cars on the road. It's more, because we will see more and more autonomous or automated systems in our daily life. So we have it in the military area already somehow, and we will see it in the next step on the road. But we will see it also in private households and factories and so on. So the car industry is recently the driver for this technology, but we will see it in other areas as well. And I want to answer this with five focus topics I want to address for the research area. It's first of all the safety and the testability of these systems. When is a system safe enough? What's the question about that? If you are looking actually to the standardization we see there for road traffic, the ISO 26262, then we see some figures like the probability for failure is 10 up minus 9, might be for autonomous driving or automated driving in the future. It might be more or 10 up minus 11 or 12. But nevertheless, there is a probability for failure. Every technical system can fail, and we have to deal with that. But on the other hand, this testability and safety of the system, how are we proving that? So the calculation very simply shows that 1 billion kilometers on the road is not enough for driving to show that the system is fulfilling these conditions. So we have to find new ways for testing, proving, and certification. And this cannot be done on a national level. It has to be done on an international level, because mankind has to accept to this. So there is a need for harmonization, and the way how we come to that with modeling, with simulation, and so on. So it's not the old way we did in the past, bringing the car on the road, just driving several million kilometers or miles, and it's done. So it's a change, a paradigm change in testing and system verification. The second point is the man-machine interface. Actually, as it was explained, we will not see the autonomous car on the road in the next years. It will take some time. So we will have more a way to automation and more functionality, which will help the driver to avoid accidents, and this functionality will increase in amount. So, but when we accept that the driver is a backup for the system because the technical system is failing, how fast is the driver coming back into the loop? What is happening to the driver during that time? Is he still able to take over this system? How are we supervising the driver? Whether it is possible and so on. So this is an open question. The question varies today, actually the answers from 10 seconds up to 15 minutes. So you see how big the variance here is, and we have to find the right way how we can solve this problem. Third point is the security and privacy. As soon as a car is driving autonomously or automated on the road, some manufacturers and researchers are expecting that this is done with a lot of environmental information got from sensors, from maps, and so on. But these data transferred to the car could be corrupted. What is happening then? Who is liable at the end? How are we guaranteeing that the data is the data which is expected? And who is liable at the end if this data is not correct? How are we dealing with such problems? The fourth point is the social and ethic impacts we have here. It's also a research arena. So what is happening if a machine is causing an accident? Actually, drivers are causing accidents. So this is a big difference. Are we accepting in societies, and societies are different around the globe, when this is happening, that the machine has a choice between two bad situations? Every situation is causing an accident, but the machine is making a choice. And the choice of the machine can be followed up because it's programmed. If the same choice would be done by a human, it's different. And fourth, it's the real path to autonomous systems, because one of the capabilities of autonomous systems is that they are learning. So these are not systems which have a fixed state and are delivered to the customer at the end. They will change over lifetime. And this is still happening actually when we have autonomous driving or automated driving car, because as soon as this car is using maps from outside of the car, these maps will change over time. So that means the complete system is changing over time. There is some learning in the system. It might be in the car, it might be outside of the car, but the system will never remain the same as it was in the starting point. And how are we dealing with that? And how are we guaranteeing that these systems are still safe?
Thank you. We are going to return to a bunch of those discrete points momentarily, because I have like a million questions about that. But I want to hear from Levi Tilleman, who is the Jeff and Carl Leonard Fellow at the New America Foundation, author of a book about electric cars. And so this is a really interesting element of the story. This is, of course, not the first time that we have had or tried major transitions from one form of automotive technology to another. Some have been more successful than others, and some of them have been promised for very long periods of time without actually materializing in the form that we imagined. What are the lessons for earlier transitions to the current set of transitions, and specifically when you think about the experience of the attempt to make the vehicle fleet electric rather than internal combustion engine based? How much does that make you optimistic or pessimistic about, you know, grand promises of removing human agency or minimizing human agency from the driving in the first place?
Good question. So first of all, thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to be part of this discussion. And secondly, before I get right into the question, I want to talk a little bit about what I think about when I think about autonomous vehicles, which is my experience growing up driving around in a car. I had 10 brothers and sisters, and as you can imagine, that's quite a brood to manage. And so my mom would be sitting in the front, driving around, angling the rearview mirror, trying to look at us and yell at us while she was sitting in the front of the car and manage all of those things at the same time. And so I can very easily imagine an autonomous system being somewhat more safe than the alternative when it comes to big families.
Yeah, humans are really overrated.
Yeah. So I will then also say Happy Mother's Day, Mom. You kept us safe all those years, and We really appreciate it. So getting back to my book and the lessons that we can glean from autonomous or from electric vehicles for autonomous vehicles, you know, I think the first thing that I would say is that these massive societal technology transitions don't just happen. They're driven by policy, and it's really important to remember that. And what my book is it's really an international examination of what policies are effective and what policies aren't effective, and how those policies can be applied strategically over the course of decades. It primarily looks at China, Japan, and the United States, which are the three largest automotive producers in the world. Cumulatively, they produce more than 50% of the automobiles in the global economy. And it comes to kind of an interesting conclusion, which is that while all three of these huge economies and the governments that manage them or are regulating them were pushing for electrification during the period stretching from 2007 to really the present day, there was another factor that happened to have a much bigger influence on electrification and really ended up being the technology driver for the entire global automotive industry, and that was the state of California. And the reason why is that the state of California has an institution embedded within their government called the California Air Resource Board that made it a priority to drive automakers towards electrification. And they did this over the course of decades, and they used a very specific set of market-based tools paired with mandates in order to make that happen. What they did was they told automakers that if you want to sell cars in California, then you have to make a percentage of them electric, which is a mandate. But that mandate is kind of draconian and potentially very expensive and inefficient. What if a car maker doesn't have particular expertise in electric vehicles? That could force them to develop a whole new set of technical capabilities that maybe they don't want to invest in at that moment. So the thing that California did to make this system much more efficient is they overlaid a market on top of that mandate. And they allowed automakers to buy and sell credits that they were awarded when they sold an electric car. And so then what you had was a market-driven mandate. And that resulted in a system that was just much more efficient than it would have been if you'd had a pure mandate behind the electrification program that California set up. So I think that this is applicable to the concept of autonomous vehicles, but autonomous vehicles are also very different from electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are great. Everybody loves the Tesla Model S. I would argue it may be the best sedan in the world at this point in time. But the truth is that what we're aiming towards with electric cars is really a whole set of social goods related towards climate, pollution, energy security, and other things like that. I personally, as you can tell from my introduction, can see many reasons why an individual might very much want to have an autonomous vehicle. And so I think that there are going to be much more powerful market drivers for automation than there were for electrification. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that we don't have to think strategically about the regulatory aspects and the industrial policy underlying the transition from standard vehicles that we all drive ourselves to autonomous vehicles. And so, I think we should take the lessons from California and realize that, a very small corner of the global economy, if they act strategically and apply policies strategically over a long period of time, can actually end up setting the agenda. And that's why forums like this and bringing together the United States and Germany to talk about global cooperation on standards and on a roadmap for autonomy going forward is so critically important.
Thanks. So finally, last but by no means least, Sonia Smith is professor of mechanical engineering and at Howard University. And I want to ask you about this international cooperation aspect. Jonathan Margolis alluded to it or talked about it very directly in the introductory remarks. Several of your co-panelists have alluded to it as well. When we think about auto development historically, we don't think of sort of international cooperation, right? We think of Detroit, or we think of, places in Japan or Germany, but these very kind of local, you know, engineering hubs, right, where you know, great cars were built, and we think of them in very regional terms. Why is this different, and what is the consequence of, you know, A, having a significant global cooperation dimension to this, or B, in a negative sense, not having it? Why does the global side of it matter?
Well, thank you, and I echo my panelists and thank Brookings for asking me to be here. I think as the educator on the panel, I need to emphasize that part of the answers to these questions, be it research and driving the technology further, has to do with incorporating students and faculty in global collaborations. At Howard University, we are one of the institutions in the Partnership for the Advancement of Collaborative Engineering Education. And it's a partnership among General Motors, Siemens, and some others to catalyze collaborative global projects in education. And so I think that in order to answer these questions and why this is important, we need to not only involve researchers at companies and faculty, but also students as well. One of the things that we do in the PACE Consortium is we collaborate on global design competitions. And this involves teams of students and faculty from universities across the globe. The team that Howard University is partnering with is one at Rhein-Main in Germany, University of Sao Paulo, University of Toronto, and New Mexico State here in the United States. And we're partnering on a global design project, and these students work together in order to answer these kinds of questions. We exchange interns. We have an intern here from Rhein-Main who's in the audience. Anik Palaf is here. And it's a very, very rich experience. And the students are the ones that are going to be the early adopters and drivers of the technology. And to get back to your question of why it's important to have a global perspective as opposed to the original siloed engineering aspects, when we talk about autonomous vehicles, that subject spans all disciplines. It's an interdisciplinary problem. It not only spans policy, it spans engineering, it spans creative design, it also spans atmospheric science, et cetera. And when you get all of these disciplines together, particularly in the educational arena, it definitely enriches and enhances the educational experience for not only the students here in the United States, but also globally.
So I want to just push you a little bit on why is this truer in the area of autonomous vehicles than it is in other vehicles? Or is it just that the scope of the research necessary to do these things is so vast? Why is it that we see these international collaborations involving companies, students, you know, universities in this area, but we didn't see it when it was, or maybe we did and we just didn't talk about it when it was, you know, earlier generations of cars?
I think that there were different types of collaborations early on, but as we move, as the vehicles become more complex, the issues become more complex. You need a collaborative and global approach in order to solve the problems. It's not just pipes and pumps from, you know, mechanical engineering and, you know, software from computer science. You also need policy involved in that. Aesthetics is extremely important. And so, you know, we need to reach out to colleagues and disciplines that we might not otherwise incorporate in a design or engineering type vehicle process.
All right, so I want to talk about safety. A bunch of people have raised safety. And we started with the possibility of the promise of a zero accident fatality road system. This sounds totally fantastical, except that in defense of this completely fantastical hypothesis, I want to point out that this year it is safer to fly in the United States than not to fly in the United States. All kinds of accidents happen in your home. you're actually safer on a commercial airplane than you are not traveling. And so that, so just,
cool.
just the more, the, right. the yeah, more you think about that, the more interesting it gets. So, I mean, the possibility of truly radical, de-escalation of the violence associated with roads is, I mean, you don't have to get to zero before you get to something that's really attractive as a policy matter. On the other hand, as we heard, the deaths that do happen will happen because of machines. And as we see in the military context, when machines cause human death as opposed to people causing human death, we get really, really uncomfortable with this. And so I want to throw this open to the panel in general. If you have a regime, technologically and policy, in which many, many fewer people die, but those deaths are caused without human agency and by programming decisions made remotely and or systems failures, is that a win, or is that something that we're going to have great social difficulty accepting?
I guess I'll try to tackle that first. I think that this is another example of one of the issues that needs to be discussed across country borders. This is something that is cultural, which, as we know, is different in different cultures around the world. Thoughts on these issues, as well as the technology, et cetera. And this is something that the OEMs, us manufacturers, are really looking at right now. And we haven't had to as much before on other technical issues. The ethics of this kind of technology, as someone mentioned before, the issue of an inevitable crash and what the computer programming should look like for something like that, and the liability in a situation like that. The ethics of how to program these kinds of technologies is really tantamount, paramount. So I think that this is something that we're going to be looking at already this year. One of our board members, Christine Holman-Denhart, has convened a group of academia, as well as technical experts and representatives from the EU and the German government, to come together and discuss the ethics of this every couple of months moving forward, because this is going to have big implications.
Right. So I want to just, you know, when I drive down the street, and I am, this has never happened to me, by the way, but you think about it, you're in a situation where there is no good option. Somebody's going to get hurt no matter what you do. And you make a split second decision. There is no policy behind that decision. But it amounts to, I'm going to kill that person, not that person, or I'm going to risk that person's life to protect my own life. You don't make a policy decision. There's no global policy about that. But when you replace my mind with a computer, you have to have a policy about that. And you have to, and it's called code. And it amounts to a policy level decision on the part of the programming to kill X person instead of Y person. And I'm just, you know, what are the ethics of that?
Of course, it's a matter of the ethics. But the difference is, you know, if we are able with autonomy to really reduce the number of accidents on the roads, first of all, that's a big advantage. And we have to admit this as well. So the second thing is, as soon as a machine is causing an accident, with full transparency, we know what is the rule behind it. At least you can follow up the complete process. As long as a human is causing an accident, you know nothing. You have a split second decision, as you said, and what is happening there? Who's really able to judge in a split second what is the best choice we have here? And the program, the algorithms, they made a choice, and they made a choice based on a rule system which they have behind them. And as long as the whole process is transparent, at least we know what is happening here. And now we have to discuss which kind of rules are behind that. And that's the ethic decision. And we have to do it somehow, somewhere. What is better if you have the choice? A or B, both causing an accident? But that's something we have to go on. And then we have to make these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important issue, and obviously it has to be addressed. And it's a very Washington issue. You know, I think it's an issue that lends itself to a lot of Washington navel-gazing and sort of hemming and hawing, and this is really important.
Don't complain about Washington navel-gazing in the Falk Auditorium.
We need to think about this really carefully. But 30,000 people die every year in auto accidents. Yeah. My father died in an auto accident. His father died in an auto accident. This is something that affects us all very personally. And if we have the prospect of potentially eliminating 90% of those auto accidents, that's a win. And, you know, just back to the personal example, you know, my father died because of a mechanical malfunction on his car, that, you know, there was nothing he could do about it. We were in the mountains, in Colorado, and he was driving and there was a mechanical malfunction and he ended up going off the side of the road. His dad died because of a human error. Someone was driving drunk and slammed into him. And, you know, if you have the prospect of potentially eliminating 90%, 95% of accidents or fatalities on the road through autonomy, I think much more important than hemming and hawing over the, we have to get machines to make these decisions, is to let's save, you know, the 27,000 lives.
Okay, so I agree with you completely, and I'm very Benthamite about, you know, reducing death. And when I make exactly this argument in the context of robotic weapon systems, there is a mobilized constituency of human rights activists who take the view that, you know, if you can have dramatically greater compliance with the laws of war as a result of fully autonomizing certain weapon systems, they object to it because you have removed human agency from the task of killing. And so I wonder if those of us who believe that actually aggregate death reduction is a really, really great good that should presumptively trump a lot of other goods are actually going to have a really tough hill to climb just in terms of social acceptance of the idea that removing people from the chain of command that leads to death is somehow presumptively suspect. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think that you have to, again, step back. And although from a policy perspective and from a logical perspective, it seems like these things are, you know, apples and apples, I think from a human perspective, they look like apples and oranges. What you're talking about are robots that kill people. And the thing that, you know, we're talking about here today are robots that transport people and try to keep them safe. And so I can understand why there would be a constituency that would mobilize against, you know, robots that kill people, just like there are people that mobilize against guns and, you know, nuclear weapons. And I think that, yes, there are probably going to be Luddites that are opposed to autonomous vehicles. But at the end of the day, we have to make some pragmatic social decisions. And I think the weight of public opinion is going to be on the side of saving lives.
So do you find, Sonia, that in these educational and development partnerships, that the safety and sort of ethics issues associated with safety are kind of front and center of what people are working on, or are they kind of background issues that are concerns, but mostly there's just a lot of excitement about the technology?
Well, there is a lot of excitement about the technology, but I would also look at it from a different perspective. Saving lives is not only through autonomy going to be achieved through deaths, reducing the deaths in auto accidents. Autonomy is also going to affect mobility and access to other services that will also save lives. Healthcare is one of them. So I think that in the whole, in the aggregate, that autonomy is not, it will not be looked at through the same lens as just saving lives through automobile accidents. And those are the type of the policy issues and holistic issues that we look at through these partnerships.
So flesh that out. What's an example of, you know, it's not merely reduced traffic accidents, where we've heard about sort of environmental benefits, particularly with respect to fuel efficiency in the truck fleet. But what's an example of social, you know, great social goods and reduced human suffering as a result of autonomy that is not autonomous vehicles, that is not, you know, fewer traffic accidents?
We don't have specific evidence, but an example that has been studied and talked about is, again, access to health care in rural communities. People who are disabled, they may be able to get access to health care, to services, much quicker through an autonomous vehicle or an autonomous fleet of vehicles than either waiting for their friend or having to walk or to get to a service. And so that is one life-saving result, not a direct design design point, but it's definitely an indirect benefit of autonomy. And I think, again, if you look at not only lives saved through reduced auto accidents, but also lives saved through personal mobility and access, I think the autonomous argument is quite different from the drone strike, et cetera, that you talked about.
Yeah, and I'd like to just add one thing to that, which is a couple of years ago, I was at the doctor's office, and as I was coming out, there was a gentleman in his electric scooter, and he was, you know, severely disabled, guy about my age. And I started talking with him and saying, hey, you've got a really cool electric car there, because I was writing about electric cars. And he said, yeah, but you know, what we're really looking forward to in the community of people with disabilities is autonomous vehicles, because there's so many things that autonomous vehicles can allow us to do that we just can't do on our own right now. And so I think that's a really compelling human argument.
All right. So one issue that autonomous vehicles necessarily raise is data collection. These are incredibly sophisticated sets of many, many sensors, all of them collecting a lot of data and processing a lot of data in order to make decisions. Data collection gets controversial, and it has different cultural baggage in different countries to different degrees. And this strikes me as an area where harmonization across borders might be pretty difficult, particularly between Germany and the United States, which, as many of you know, fight about data a lot, not just in the NSA context, but also principally in the business context. So now you have 15 years from now, a giant fleet of big data machines roaming around every city. What are the prospects for A, regulatory harmony on this subject across borders, and B, what are the prospects for cultural queasiness associated with the idea of our cars as pervasive surveillance devices?
I will answer to that. So, first of all, we have to differentiate these sensor cluster machines running around the cities or everywhere in the country. They are collecting a lot of data, but what is happening with this kind of data? So is the car relying on data outside of this car to drive autonomously, or must the car also drive without data from outside the car? There is a separation between that, what the car needs from outside, and what the car is generating by itself. Because everything what he's generating by itself, it can forget immediately after the driving situation. So this is in the research community not quite clear what is the right path for autonomous driving vehicles in the future. The fraction who is thinking about that we need a lot of data from around the car, from the city sensors and so on, they then have immediately the problem, what is the privacy and security of this data? Because data used from outside the car to drive autonomously can corrupt the car, can corrupt the driving situation. We have, again, this is safety issues and all these things. Secondly, as soon as the car is sending data outside of itself, who is the owner of this data? Who can use that data? Is it the driver? Is it the car owner? Is it the car manufacturer? Is it society? These are open questions we have to discuss, because, and this is a cultural issue as well around the globe. It's not in every country the same. So there we need harmonization anyhow, how we want to regard that in the future. One thing is for sure, as soon as data is available, it will be used, and it will be used for business. It was always the same story in the world, and it will happen here again. So as soon as the data is outside of the car available, it will be used. That's for clear.
I just want to underline that. I mean, I think that this is a perfect time to really explain why this kind of collaboration between governments, between companies, and between legislative bodies and corporations makes so much sense. It's really important, and of course, informed by academic bodies as well. We do a lot of research with universities around the world and have been for decades. Obviously, most companies do interface with government at different levels, both regulatory bodies, diplomatic missions, executive, etc. So these kinds of collaborations are absolutely necessary because we need to make sure that moving forward, the technology is advancing generally at the same pace as a societal adoption, society's willingness to accept this kind of technology, and at the same parallel speed as the laws and regulations. Because we want to make sure that these are harmonized, and we have an opportunity with this kind of technology to do so. Obviously, cars have been around a really long time. We invented the car almost 130 years ago. And at that time, there was really no need at all for Germany and the U.S. to be talking about safety regulations in automobiles. Now there is overwhelming need for all of these countries to be discussing this together. So we have a new kind of technology that needs to be addressed societally and legislatively, and we have the opportunity now to be doing that across country lines, as informed by the experts with the technology and privacy data experts, as well as the mechanical experts, etc. So I think that's something that we can't overlook, and as this process moves forward, there's no choice but to be working together.
And I will also say that automated vehicles are, or autonomous vehicles are, just one small facet, or a significant facet, of the changing relationship between data and vehicles. You know, we are moving towards a world of connected vehicles, where our cars will have, you know, huge amounts of media and internet connectivity. An era where you're going to have connections between vehicles and the infrastructure in the city that tell the car, you know, how fast to go and what kind of traffic situation is going ahead. And so that's a new stream of data. Cars will be connected to each other via vehicle-to-vehicle technology. And that is something that is under development, and we have, you know, whole regulatory structures that are being built up around it as well. And finally, you have this uppermost tier of automated vehicles. And so I think we have to think very carefully about data and transportation and how we're going to manage that emerging relationship.
All right. So several of you have alluded to, as distinct from safety issues, what we might call cybersecurity issues with respect to, you have all this data, you have these systems that are autonomous, both the data streams and the systems themselves that are operating the vehicles, like any complex computer system, are subject to attack, as we have seen, or in the case of the data, corruption, as we have seen in other areas that we have systematically networked and become very dependent on. These become very attractive targets for hackers from the lowest grade to the most state-sponsored. Is this a situation where we are now creating dependencies that we will eventually turn around and say, oh my God, how did we come to give, you know, the North Koreans control over our traffic safety? Just to use an example, I'm sure has nothing to do with the news. I mean, why shouldn't we be worried? How worried should we be about the cybersecurity implications of having basically our cars as, you know, the operations of our cars as networked instruments, both in their own internal systems and the data that they're collecting and relying on for safe operation?
From my perspective as an optimist also, I actually am not so concerned about this. I think that it definitely needs to be done right, and this is another area where we need to be talking between private and public sectors across country borders to really effectively regulate these issues and make sure we're thinking about them in the right way. I know in our company we have basically internal hackers who are tasked with trying to hack our vehicles all the time. It's amazing, as I said before, some of the systems which are in your passenger cars today are already very advanced and already maybe starting to inch up on the scale of automation, such as these kind of lane assist and adaptive cruise control, the braking I mentioned, et cetera. These kinds of issues, even in some of our cars, we have systems which will notice if you're getting sleepy, not by looking at you, but by how you're sitting and how you're driving compared to when you were driving when you first started the car. And it will flash a little coffee cup on your dash to tell you, hey, why don't you take a break now? So those kinds of systems are collecting data on you as a driver. And the way that that data is stored is certainly cause for debate. But we think that, I can only speak to our company, but we are, because we're based in Germany, we are probably the most stringent. We're subject to the most stringent data laws possibly on Earth. So we're confident that moving forward that's the view we'll take.
When we're talking about this data privacy and security at the end, maybe we have to differentiate between data which are necessary to drive autonomously and not all the data we have in the car. We have a lot of more data, as it was mentioned already. So this kind of entertainment data, it's just a free flow of data, and every user can decide what he wants to do with that. And this is actually, according to some agreements between the provider and the user and so on. And the data we have in the car to drive this car somehow autonomous in the future. It happened already in the past that cars were hacked. So that's not a new issue. We know that already. In the research arena, it's a known problem. So, and it will happen. This is for sure. So to make, first of all, the right choice, what is really necessary for the automation of the car, and as small as this amount of data is, it's more difficult to attack it. So if we need everything, what we get around from the car, every camera system in the city, then it can be corrupted very easily. If it's just a small amount of data or maybe no data, that the car is collecting everything by himself, keeping it for himself and deleting it afterwards, then we have not such a big issue at the moment. So, and as I said, cars were corrupted in the past already. So you can hack a car and put some wrong data into it. Because in the future we will see, with the autonomous vehicles, we see a different kind of car in the future. Quite sure, you can load your own apps down to the car, you have your special driving functions and so on. This will be the future of the cars, not just this autonomous driving. This is just one of the functionalities. So as soon as you are bringing new software into the car, you can corrupt the car in another way. And this we have to protect. So we have to be very, very precise. It's not all the data, it's just a few. And as fewer this amount is, as better we can protect it. Nevertheless, we have to have the public discussion what will happen if something is corrupted.
And for sure, this is why we see so many redundancies also. I should have mentioned that.
And obviously, it's not just cars. You know, there's so many facets of our economy where this is a huge issue. The energy system. I just came from a 2-year appointment to the Department of Energy, and we think about this all the time because all these systems are now connected to networks. And, you know, if you have someone break through the control system of a nuclear power plant or even a, you know, more traditional coal or gas-fired power plant or into the grid, that can cause some pretty huge problems. So this is definitely a big issue, and I think it's an economy-wide issue.
And it's an example, I just read a report recently about commercial aviation and how secure, aviation systems are. And the answer seemed to be that they're quite secure as long as they don't interface with the public interfacing, the public-facing computer systems on airplanes, which are not secure at all. The trouble is we've now interlaced them because people like to watch flight data on their little computer screens. And so these two systems now interact in ways that, you know, create vulnerabilities for the other systems. Let us go to audience questions. If you have a question, flag me and please wait for the microphone. We've got a lot of questions. The gentleman over here I saw first. Please introduce yourself and please keep questions brief.
Thank you. I'm Nick Farmer. Could you speak to the idea of fully autonomous vehicles in a shared use environment? That is, not as a personal car that I own, but as a fleet vehicle that I use, sort of like the Daimler Car to Go, but fully autonomous, can deliver packages, can deliver food, can deliver people, can replace cars, buses, taxis in an urban environment. It seems like to me that paradigm change, really looking at it much differently than trying to replace each individual's car, has a lot more opportunity for quicker implementation.
Absolutely. I think that when you're talking about fleets, this is something we're already seeing. Ben mentioned a couple of times military use, not only drones, but talking about land vehicles in the military, looking at the fleets there, they're definitely looking at this kind of technology. From a consumer perspective, something like Car2Go is kind of a perfect platform for this kind of technology. You see it here in Washington, D.C. Those of you who travel to other cities, we're in lots of cities around the world. You see these little smart cars, which are a little bit reminiscent, if anyone has seen the Google's perception of what an autonomous car will look like in the future that doesn't even have a wheel at all, but is kind of like a little transportation pod for one or two people. And these kinds of systems are meant for urban environments, like you said, because they're small, they're not for long road trips, and generally go at lower speeds, which I think will definitely contribute to some more consumer acceptance of this kind of technology in an urban environment. So not only from a safety perspective, but you said it has consumer applications as well. These kinds of companies like Amazon or McDonald's are looking at same-day delivery in certain cities, you know, get your Big Mac in 2 hours, these kinds of things. This is going to be definitely contributing to that kind of an economy moving forward. So we like to think that because we have this multi-layered system internally within Daimler, that we have these platforms available not only, you know, everywhere from the small smart car to the 18-wheeler heavy-duty freight liner, that this kind of technology can be applied to in different settings. And it's just something that, like we said, we need to work on the regulation to make sure that that we're in lockstep.
Can I just say one thing on that? So I think you hit on a really important topic. And there's a heading in my book, which is when 2 + 2 = 10. And the truth is, when you synergize these, you know, technologies of car sharing and autonomy and electrification and fleet management, and, you know, you get all of these terrific possibilities in terms of more efficient use of capital, urban land management, you know, just imagine if you could just eliminate parking. That is a huge amount of land within the city that we could use for so many productive causes. And so I think that it's really important for us to think about these issues systemically and not to just take them piecemeal and to figure out, you know, what are the ultimate implications of potentially bringing some of these various technologies together. And so I think it's a terrific question and something we have to think a lot about.
My name is Evelyn Smith. I'm with the American Enterprise Institute. My question is for Jessica. You were mentioning that in the autonomous trucks that are being tested now in Nevada, that there's still a vehicle manager in the car. So I think there's a public perception that this technology is going to eliminate a lot of jobs. But it seems like that's not the case, at least in the short term. So is there a different level of skill that's required to be a vehicle manager? Is there a different type of job that we think will replace, say, truck drivers or Uber drivers?
Absolutely. I think that's a good question. And it's exciting for people in this field because I think we are looking at the elevation of this kind of a career, from a driver to, like you said, a manager, someone who is monitoring all of the systems in the vehicle. This is a high-tech job, advanced training. And actually, I was at an event here in this room a few weeks ago about advanced industries and the kinds of education that are going to be necessary moving forward for different kinds of industries in this country. And I think that this is a perfect example that, unlike, say, travel agents, you know, that we don't see too many of them around anymore, this is a job, this is a career that's going to transform. I don't see layoffs necessarily. I see the elevation of this kind of a career. And especially because once someone in this kind of career is trained like this, that provides a lot more opportunity than the current kind of truck driver role. So from the technical perspective, obviously we're going to need a human for the time being in cars and trucks, even with high levels of autonomy, even once commercial licenses are granted in certain states and countries. But looking several decades down the line, that's the time when we're looking at possibly no one in the car at all. And that's something that Sonia alluded to with the disabled community. I was at CES earlier this year with the Mercedes-Benz F015, our completely autonomous sedan. And we had a big group of disabled advocates for the disabled communities who wanted to talk about the implications of this kind of technology for the blind, the deaf, people with severe physical disabilities who are completely unable to manage their own transportation as it stands right now.
So if no one else says something, I just feel like I have to. Are there going to be layoffs? Yes. Are there going to be lots of layoffs? Yes. Is artificial intelligence and deep learning transforming the way our economy works? Definitely. Will there be new jobs? Yes. Will there be as many new jobs as the old jobs that we lose? Unclear. So I just think that it's really important that we think about these issues in a, you know, eyes wide open kind of way and realize that we are moving towards an era where computers will be able to do a lot of the things that only a human can do today. And actually, there's a huge feature piece in The Economist about it for this coming week. And I recommend it. I think it's very well done. And I think that anyone who looks at these issues in a balanced way is going to have to admit that there are going to be a lot of layoffs and there's going to be a huge transition. And the kind of job that is available right now to a truck driver will not necessarily be available, you know, 10, 15 years from now. And we have to think about that from a policy perspective and plan for it.
Just want to say something about that, so the layoffs. There was a simulation of Singaporean University to replace the complete taxi business by car sharing. It was done on a university level first. And then they came to the result, it's possible. The service time for the customer in the average time is better than with a taxi because it's a shorter waiting time. And then they said, okay, but we still need people to reallocate the fleet. And this was then the third of the taxi drivers. So two-thirds laid off. They made the same simulation with autonomous driving. So then they have to increase the numbers of cars because the cars have to reallocate themselves, but then you need no drivers any longer.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Bordang with Nature, and I had a question for Jessica and for Carl Joseph about reliable automation and ethics. So as I understand, one of the things that's quite difficult if you're an autonomous car making a decision between, say, if you have to brake quickly to save the person in the car versus, but that could cause a chain reaction or something, is that it's quite difficult for computer programs to deal with things like counterfactuals and calculating, you know, whether it's better to do one thing versus the other. And I wonder, what are Daimler and Siemens and engineers who deal with this thinking about in terms of the right approach to making those calculations? Do we know that ethical decisions of this kind can actually be reliably automated and reliably computed by a machine? And do we need to know that before we can have things like, say, I know Mercedes, one of Daimler's marks, is doing testing in California. Do we need to know, and how much do we know before we can actually sort of have these ethical questions answered in terms of what the car is capable of doing?
The question is not so difficult to answer. So as soon as you have an algorithm, you know what this algorithm is doing. It's decided before something is happening. The rules are fixed. It's programmed. So you know exactly how the car is behaving. So if he has a choice to make an accident left, right, or the car coming from behind, you know it. The situation is no. So the calculation time, it's just making a selection between a few choices. It's done much faster than the human brain. So you know exactly this will happen in this situation, like this or this or this. So we have to make that transparent, that we want to have this reaction so we can discuss situations before they are happening.
So is there an ethical obligation to make the algorithms public? To make the choice to say, okay, we're choosing, if you have a choice between killing a kid and killing an adult, you kill the adult. Or you kill the kid, whatever your choice is. I mean, I'm being reductionist, but I mean, when you have a tragic choice and you have an engineer, a prospective engineering out answer to that, is there an ethical obligation to lay it out and to let, you know, imagine the Washington Post headline or the New York Times headline, Siemens engineers killing kid? You know, do you have to do that, or are you allowed to have a proprietary killing kid algorithm?
It's a time. Interesting question. Yeah, but you have to see the following points. So we are making now this discussion explicit. We want to have it in the public. We want to have it in the parliaments of the world. That's the discussion we have to have at the end. This discussion or this question you are asking. Physician somewhere in the world, in the third world, has to do this decision every day.
Yep.
Every day he has to do this decision. It's an ethical, moralical decision, and nobody is helping him with this. And now, as we have it in our public here, we have to discuss it. We have to decide before. And if we are not making that decision, we are blaming the engineer. That's the wrong way.
So I want to add one thing, that these decisions will also be adaptive. So they will evolve and they will change, and they will also be dependent upon region, government, et cetera. Yeah. The same way the physician in one part of the country in the same situation is not going to make the same decision. And so the same will be true of these algorithms.
Yeah. And I would also say that this is an area that calls out for regulatory guidelines, yeah. And for government decisions. I mean, we make these decisions every day. We decide, you know, how much SO2 are we going to allow coal-fired power plants to emit, and that kills people. And, you know, I think that, you know, when it comes to making these big ethical decisions about how stringently are we going to regulate certain kinds of technologies and who lives and who dies, that is actually the appropriate role of a policymaker in many senses.
And I think that as you mentioned the transparency issue, this is something that we are discussing within the framework of the ethical debate to begin with. And I know that the other German automakers are also having these discussions. It was in the news this week, one of our competitors voiced a concern that they didn't think that the ethical concerns could be surmounted, which we disagree with. We think it's certainly worth discussing, but if years go by and there are still no answers, then that's something that we'll have to tackle at the time internationally.
I just want to point out that when I referenced the problem that the military and the covert, you know, agencies have had in attempting to engineer exactly this, you know, civilian harm reduction problem, you said, well, it'll be totally different because, you know, these are robots designed to transport people, not robots designed to kill people. And yet, here we are having exactly the same conversation. And one of the,
that's partially because you're asking the questions.
I didn't ask this question.
But still the difference is that in a military system, the program is to kill people. The principal problem that you have on the road is different. We want to transport people. it's an exception. It's a situation of accidents. And then it's a decision and not for normal driving.
So which is the company that has decided that the ethical problems are not surmountable?
BMW hinted this week that they are concerned about that.
Yes.
My name is Alan Pizarski. I'm a consultant and a researcher in transportation, travel behavior, and public investment. I'm wondering about the critical interface, perhaps, between public investment and infrastructure and technologies that we're talking about. Are there game breakers? Are there critical interfaces that are important to the future, or are you going to be able to engender this activity autonomously outside of whatever public investments are undertaken?
So I think that that's something that has to be studied very carefully, and that's actually my next project, is to look at what that interface is and what are the critical roadblocks from a policy perspective, and how we have to get our house in order to allow automakers to innovate towards this future that is potentially much more efficient, much safer, you know, socially optimizing. So that's actually, you know, I would say it's something that calls out for further research.
That's also, I want to bring up here, in terms of infrastructure, the spectrum use issue, which is a little bit of a hot topic here in DC if you follow these issues right now. And that's something that we feel very strongly about preserving, that band of the spectrum for automotive use. And so this is something that, even though we're talking about vehicles 10 or 15 years from now, it is going on right now from a policy perspective.
And while we've got, and when you're done with the mic, just pass it to the gentleman in back of you.
My name is Brad Townsend. I'm with OurEnergyPolicy.org. And I just had a question, again, to touch on the safety issue, and it sort of builds on some of what has already been asked. I think I tend to agree with Eli that the public support would be towards the net reduction. However, I do think that there could be potential pushback, specifically looking at who's responsible for making those programming decisions, whether that's the company or a regulatory agency. And so I'm wondering what the current regulatory framework looks like in terms of being able to support those types of decisions, particularly with the international angle as part of it.
So I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I completely got the question. The question is...
There is a terrific paper by John Villasenor, which I think copies of are out there, about liability issues, product liability issues with respect to driverless cars and road liability issues. A lot of what you're describing as a regulatory architecture in this country is not a regulatory architecture. It's a liability and blame assignment after the fact architecture. Yeah. And, you know, the question of how you apply that legal system to a system in which the point person on the decision may not be the driver is a very hard one, and I don't think we entirely know the answer to it yet.
That's right. And I would say these systems are embryonic. They're taking shape. In some states, autonomous vehicles are kind of illegal or undefined. In some states, they're legal, and there are, you know, regulatory mechanisms that apply to who drives them, how they're driven, where they can be driven. And then on a federal level, you have a push towards defining, you know, how regulatory agencies will deal with autonomy. NHTSA is working very, you know, very assiduously on their connected vehicles policies right now. This is something that we have to get on and think very creatively about from a regulatory standpoint, starting now, because it's coming soon.
And I think, honestly, to piggyback on that, the framework is set up, or at least getting set up. I know the DOT has a 2015 through 2019 multimodal plan for vehicle automation that they're working on between the U.S., the EU, and Japan already. This is a working group which has already been established. There already have been several meetings, the correct people identified. So these kinds of discussions are well-placed already and have started.
I mean, another just dimension of this is that unlike, you know, the other area where this kind of automation is really taking place, which is in, you know, in aviation of one sort or another, you do have a federal state issue here that is peculiar, which is that traditionally the licensing agency for driving is your state government. And now you're talking about the agency's, you know, the decision-making entity being a commercial product that is, you know, presumably doesn't have a license from the District of Columbia to operate a motor vehicle. And so there's a question of how much autonomy does a car have before you really lose the foundations of, you know, state licensing rules that have governed car driving for the last 100+ years.
It's going to be a tremendous undertaking to look at these regulations, many of which were established in countries and states decades and decades ago, even a century ago, and look at amending them.
And I would say this is...
So we have a gentleman shaking his head with annoyance. But let this gentleman ask his question, and then when you're done, pass to the gentleman who wants to correct me.
All right. I might like to note that there is a third option when you were killing the kid or the adult. Kill the occupants of the autonomous vehicle. That's just a third alternative in the algorithm.
I'm sure that'll be of great comfort, too.
My concern is really dealing with deployment of this technology, because it was my good fortune to be part of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the 70s. We had an autonomous vehicle running around the lab in the 1970s. The technology was on its way. That was an engineering model, but deployment and where it made sense and the continuity of programs, none of it came through. So it's 40 years ago, and here we are again. To me, you need a couple of things to go forward with, and I'd like to see anybody respond to this. One is a specific duty cycle, because that way maintenance is controlled. That way, if you're dealing with electric propulsion technology, which you don't have to do, but it could be, that is controlled also, so that you know that your system, vehicle systems, are operable when you introduce it into the rest of the system. The other is, I believe there's a hybrid that's in there, and that's what we anticipated long ago, and that is that imagine you're driving along in your BMW Z5 or 6, and you're in a nice country road.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. But, and you're on a nice country road, but you're approaching the town you want to be in. You throw it into automated mode, and you sit back and relax. The car confirms that you're in automated mode. You now proceed through a city that you know nothing about, precisely to where your destination is, and you go. When you leave, you exit in the same manner, and if you choose, take the freeway and forget the nice country road. But that choice is a great way to introduce this technology, along with mass transit, and that's the specific duty cycle, because mobility for people that don't have a driver's license, never did, or have lost it, is critical. So if you work on that, the hybrid concept, and getting mobility for all of the people, you get quick deployment and acceptance. That was my comment because I've been in this field.
Okay, so hybrid version is the road to acceptance. Thoughts?
Go ahead.
I would add another element to the hybrid road to acceptance, and that's the last mile, first mile access to a public transit system. That is a perfect way in order to sensitize the public to these technologies.
So I would just say that most automakers completely agree with you, and we love to talk about autonomous vehicles because that's sexy. You know, autonomous vehicles drive themselves. But for instance, if you go and talk to Toyota, they do not use the term autonomous vehicles. They say automated vehicles.
Automated.
And the reason why is because there are certain instances in which it's very difficult to, you know, write that line of code that decides whether someone kills a kid or they kill the dog or they kill the occupant or they kill themselves or they, you know, do something else, as yet undefined. But, you know, what Toyota likes to talk about is the fact that, you know, there are large stretches of highway and road in this country for which autonomous driving is quite simple to program and very safe. And usually that's highway driving. And then the other thing that is, you know, relatively easy to do is low speed urban driving. And you can do that from a technical perspective. It's not that big of a deal. It gets more complicated when you're moving into high speed urban driving in a very dynamic environment. And so I think what automakers would like to see is a system where we can get 80, 90% of the benefit of autonomous vehicles while leaving those last critical, difficult decisions kind of off the table, because you're never going to be driving in an environment where they're likely to arise.
From a manufacturer perspective, especially as a German manufacturer, I completely agree with you, and that's why our kind of first big stab at this in the FO15, which we released earlier this year, or showed at CES and has been traveling around the world ever since, still has a steering wheel, because in our perspective, consumers are going to want that choice and want to use the car differently on a Saturday morning versus a Monday morning. So, and not everyone necessarily wants more than one vehicle. So that's kind of the way that we see things, as having that comfort and luxury in a mobile lounge to be able to drive it when you want or when you need to, versus being able to relax when you don't.
Sure.
Thank you for recognizing a mild dissent to your comment about the federal government versus the states. I was with the House Commerce Committee as a lawyer for years. I worked on the 74 amendments to the Motor Vehicle Safety Act. I kind of know a little bit about NHTSA. But states have very little control over the equipment, the car. They license drivers, but motor vehicle safety equipment like passive restraints, which I'm surprised you guys haven't mentioned, which is the best example of forcing technology. That was a federal proposed rule 30 years before it was finally adopted. I hate to use that number, 30 years. It took a long time, but in a way that forced the technology. So I just want to point out there is some role for the states. And in a federal system, you never know what's going to happen with the Supreme Court. It doesn't affect commerce. This is a federal issue, the United States federal.
Oh, I think you misunderstood my remark. I did not mean to suggest at all that the states were the primary regulator here. What I meant to suggest was quite the opposite, that the more of the driving function you give to equipment, the more you lessen the role of the state, and the more you give to the federal government the function that we traditionally associated with the state, which was the day-to-day operative supervision of the driving function.
I think it does raise a good point about, and we see it in environmental regulation too, that certain states are doing certain things to go above and beyond what the federal government does. And if you even keep one half of an eye on the auto industry in the last several decades, you know that we push for harmonization across all states so that we don't have a patchwork of regulations, and that'll be the exact same issue we're looking at with automated driving as well.
Think it brings it back to a bigger issue around standards and collaboration and cooperation to make sure that you don't have different infrastructure in different states that is not going to, you know, allow these vehicles to cross lines and countries and places like Europe. And, you know, cars frequently travel internationally as well. So I think this whole international aspect is really critical.
We have time for one more question, and then I'm going to give each of our panelists a chance to wrap up in response, either to the question or if he or she chooses to ignore the question to anything else that moves. Sir, in the back.
Thank you all. This has been an excellent talk, and I really appreciate the different perspectives. My name's John Watts. I'm from the Noetic Group. My question is, we've kind of danced around this a little bit, and there's been several remarks regarding it, but the human factors that lead to the acceptance. So we've talked about the Tesla being arguably a superior car to the alternatives because of the design. Uber or Car2Go, pundits can have as much concerns or anxiety about the service until the second that they use it and it's more convenient. Jessica, you've mentioned about the mobile lounge. what are the design factors and the human factors that will go into the design of a vehicle that you think will make it acceptable and desirable to the actual consumer that will lead to acceptance?
This is a really interesting question, and I'm glad you brought it up because design is something that can't be ignored when we're talking about consumer acceptance, because as far as the technology and the sensors come and as far as the regulations and laws come, if people don't want to buy it, this is a problem, and this is what we're seeing right now with certain drivetrains in California and in other states. So we are a luxury car brand, and we look at this issue a little bit differently than some mainstream car brands. I point you to Google with the Google car. Looking at what that is versus what our FO15 is incredibly different. So what we might, the kind of design that we might put in an autonomous smart car in the Car2Go fleet versus something that a wealthy businessman might buy for his personal use is going to be completely different. But for us, it's the luxury, it's the comfort, and the privacy of your own space, especially when you're thinking about the cultural aspects in the U.S. of people who generally like their own space, and that's why there's some reluctance to beef up the public transport systems in this country. So we're looking at all of that and from our luxury perspective, and I'm pretty excited about the way that it's going. So I'll leave it at that as my closing remarks, too.
Let's just go straight down the line.
One last point to the autonomous driving. It was an interesting time about 5-6 years ago. We made a worldwide study. We conducted that in China and Japan and Europe and the U.S. And we were discussing in this study the point how much software, how automation we will have in the cars in the next years. And we made some predictions about that, what will happen in the future. And sorry to say, it was 6 years ago we were wrong, because now it's already announced that we have the first autonomous systems or automation systems in 2017, in the 2017s, in the 2018s, in the cars, followed by 2021 and 2022, where we have then the highway assistance system and where we have the parking assistance system, so you don't have to drive your car by yourself in your garage or on the highway. So this is coming very soon. It's coming earlier than we predicted that. It was 5-6 years earlier. And I guess that the same will happen with autonomous driving, because there is a need for it in the world. And that's a difference to that what you said with your propulsion systems in the or your autonomous car in your lab. It took also 100 years till we have a mass rollout of electric cars on the road, because we had then beginning of the last century, there were more electric taxis in New York on the road than we have then with combustion engines. They were already there, then they were gone, and they were coming again. Now these autonomous cars are coming, and I guess they are coming faster than we think already now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And so to answer your question, our discussion has been kind of safety, safety, and safety. And the answer to your question is productivity, productivity, and productivity. I mean, if you can have a mobile office that allows you to, you know, live in Herndon and commute in and be as productive in your car and as comfortable in your car as you are in your office, then that's a real game changer. And I think that the productivity gains are going to just overwhelm opposition to autonomous vehicle technology. And I think that smart automakers will be thinking about that and thinking about how they can integrate not just entertainment, but the rest of life into your vehicle as well.
I would just encourage us to think about the autonomous vehicles, not just in terms of the direct benefits, reduction in traffic accidents, but also the increased access that these types of vehicles can provide and the benefits thereto to society as well.
With that, we are going to have to close. Thank you all for coming. And thank you all for coming.